Welcome to this ICIS Chemicals podcast. Well, today the world started its COVID-19 vaccination programme with a 90-year-old grandmother in the UK being the first person to receive a dose. I'll be asking, what could a rapid rollout mean for the global economy and chemicals demand? Also, Brexit's on a knife edge yet again, with UK Prime Minister and EU President due to meet later this week to try and resolve their differences. I'm Will Beecham, and today I'm pleased to bring you two of our regular team of chemicals experts, Insight editor Nigel Davis and Paul Hodges, chairman of New Normal Consulting. Nigel, I'd like to start with you this week. You've been trying to make sense of some new forecasts and reports published for Q4 and 2021. I had a quick look at the Oxford Economics report. They seem to be very upbeat because of the likely impact of this vaccination programme, which started today. They've upgraded their 2021 GDP forecasts, and they expect sustained relaxation of restrictions in some advanced economies starting around March, April next year. Countries which were hurt most by the lockdowns will bounce back most strongly, in their view. Nigel, do you share Oxford's optimism for next year?
I think, Will, you know, Oxford have been talking particularly about sort of industrial, a recovery in industry, which I think is quite interesting and certainly important for the chemical sector. You know, they say in this particular report that the industry will be a bright spot. Near-term prospects seem more favourable as the industrial sector seems to respond now to pent-up demand. And for those people who have been lucky enough to continue working through the pandemic and the lockdowns, you know, there is money to spend, and there's quite a lot of money to sort of come out of into the economy in that respect. And also, Oxford Economics mentions that there's quite a lot of spare capacity at the moment within industry, but also stronger capital spending. So that could provide some upside surprises for the economy. And then that has to be good news for chemicals, because you know, you could build up an argument that says that there's going to be stronger sort of demand for the chemical intermediates to go into those products that we will either buy over this holiday period, upcoming holiday period, or further on into 2021. And of course, the vaccine provides the upside to that as well. And I was struck particularly yesterday by a report from the National Association for Business Economics in the US, and they do their regular survey of economists, and the panelists there were much, much more optimistic in this particular survey than they were as recently as October. I think in the latest survey, 73% expect the US economy would have returned to pre-pandemic GDP levels by the second half of 2021. And that compares with 38% in October. So, you know, something has changed there. I mean, people obviously are more upbeat because of the prospects for the vaccines to be rolled out. But one of my sort of question marks on all of this is, well, a couple of things. Firstly, is to do with logistics. You know, we start to think about how we're going to vaccinate huge numbers of people. How are we going to move the vaccines around the world? But then, of course, you know, how are we going to be moving everything else around the world at the same time? And I know, you know, we're not necessarily competing there, but we've already seen, and we've reported on in ICIS recently about some of the logistics challenges that exist. Containers not being in the right place, problems in Asia with container traffic knocking on into Europe and elsewhere. And then, of course, you've got to think how that plays out in an economy which is beginning to grow, but then we have these COVID-related restrictions. And of course, in this part of the world, I'm in London, but of course we have the problem with the upcoming end of the transition period and the possible or not trade deal between the UK and the EU, and what impact that has on logistics.
What about you, Paul? Do you share these economists' optimism for next year, or do you think the challenges that Nigel mentioned might provide a real downside?
I I'm sitting here with a kind of smile on my face, really, Will, because I'm also optimistic, but I'm optimistic for completely different reasons for what Oxford and NABE and others are saying. I don't think there's a chance in a million of all the things that they're talking about coming true. I think they're trying to assume that we're somehow going to go to back to business as usual, and that the world before the pandemic is magically going to reappear. And I could give you a list as long as my arm of things that make that impossible, you know, not just unlikely, but impossible. You know, tens of thousands of businesses in Europe and in the States, hundreds of thousands in the States, have closed and they won't come back. And, you know, people, 20 million have been unemployed in the States, you know, set similar numbers in Europe. And so, you know, all of these things, if you look at industry today, what you see is that a major paradigm shift has taken place. Spending, personal spending, for example, which obviously drives the economy, 60-70% of the economy is personal spending. And we are now spending much more in the home, on family life. We've gone back to that. We're not interested anymore in stag parties and hen parties at weekends and spending €1,000 to £1,000 jetting off somewhere in order to get drunk or whatever. Those paradigms have shifted. And you know, you can argue whether this is a good or a bad thing. I'm not taking a view on it, but people are much more concerned about things in the home. They're much more concerned about family life. And yes, they will still travel, but come on, really imagine that the airlines of the world, having basically collapsed over the last 9 months, are magically going to go back. I mean, I saw a thing that Gatwick, London's second largest airport, had 6 flights in a day last week. Normally it has 600. Now, I'm not going to argue that it may not get back to 300 or 400, but we're just not going back. But I'm optimistic because these paradigm shifts create major opportunities, really major opportunities. And companies that start to pick up on these opportunities, which are principally all around the sustainability agenda and recycling. And we've really made the breakthrough in this area. Now we've gone through the tipping point. And so it's a very exciting period, but there will be lots of very disappointed people who are going, oh, but oil isn't $100 anymore. Oh dear, GDP isn't 5%. I don't care about oil prices. I don't care about GDP. What I care about is, are we doing the most for individuals here and preserving the planet? And I think we're going to be doing a much better job of that in the next 10 years than we have for the last 10 years.
You mentioned energy there. You've also been writing about energy in your latest blog post, arguing that we can look forward to an age of energy abundance as our reliance on fossil fuels dwindle and the price of renewables decline. Why do you believe cheap energy is here to stay, Paul?
Well, because of the numbers. If you look the International Energy Agency, who are the sort of the gold standard for energy forecasts, came out with forecasts for renewable energy costs in 2010, and they updated them in 2014. And they said, they could, by the time we get to 2035, they could well be down somewhere close to parallel with oil and gas. And of course, this would make an enormous problem for climate change agendas. If you want to do that, if you're going to suddenly have to divert all this money. In fact, the really good news is that 10 years after their 2010 forecast, renewable prices have come down. They've come down to 25% of what they were forecasting for 2035. So in other words, Portugal, for example, I use in the post, Portugal bought electricity, renewable power in the summer at €11 a megawatt hour. Think of it, €11 a megawatt hour, 11, right? And by 2030, it expects to have 80% of its energy from renewables. And so, you know, you can scrap and build. And this changes the dynamics of everything that we do. We no longer have to look over our shoulder at the oil companies and refineries and have we got naphtha and have we got, none of that matters anymore. We're going back now to local manufacturing, where we have local cities doing local manufacturing. And I'm afraid, you know, the people who are expecting to go back to business as usual and you will want to build 2 million ton crackers, they're all going to be rather disappointed, I'm afraid, and lose their money. But the people who invest their money instead in recycling are going to make a fortune.
So you think the chemical industry needs to totally restructure in terms of the its production footprint to small local scale recycling and virgin and processing of virgin material?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, nothing lasts forever, and we've had a great 50 or 60 years. But if you go back to the 1960s, the leaders of the time saw that coal, which had been the mainstay of chemicals production for 100 years, you know, benzene, you know, it was originally a coal-based product. All of these were coal-based products. They saw that oil and gas were going to change the underlying paradigm, and they scrapped in a very short space of time all their coal-based production, and they went for oil and gas, and they laid the foundations for 50 or 60 years of unparalleled growth, unparalleled profit growth, unparalleled profitability, and, you know, and fantastic jobs for everybody who was involved. So we need the current generation of leaders, and I think this is happening. You know, I was the expert advisor to the World Economic Forum's CEO Task Force in the summer. And our conclusions were, look, there are all these technologies out there. It's up to chemical company CEOs to put their money where their mouth is, along with private, with public money. And there's buckets of public money available for all of this, the Green Recovery Plan, and really get on with it. I mean, CEFIC is saying this, and I'm sure the great thing that's going to happen next year is that the US industry is going to wake up. It's been held back by this appalling man, Donald Trump, and this idea that we can somehow go back to coal and all that sort. What a waste of time and energy and money. But I've worked in the States. I know that you're going to have Biden in there. And within 3 months, the tone of the discussion in the States is going to change. And you're going to look around and you're going to say, whew, I never expected that to happen. And so, you know, I'm very optimistic, because I'm absolutely sure you've got Europe, China, and now you're about to have the States all going in the same direction. This is going to be a very powerful and very positive trend for the next few years.
Yes, I can see now why you're sitting there with a smile on your face, Paul. And finally, the UK is dancing perilously close to the cliff edge of a no-deal Brexit. Boris Johnson due to meet EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen this week to try and resolve outstanding differences on fishing, unfair competition rules and how to police them. Nigel, how optimistic are you that a deal can be struck on Brexit? And how disastrous would a no deal be for UK petchems, do you think?
Well, Will, I mean, that's the question of the moment, really, sitting here in London. And honestly, I don't think anyone can tell you, because we seem to be close one day and then further, much further away the next. I mean, there was some optimism earlier in the week. Of course, it's only Tuesday. But now pessimism reigns. If you listen to what some of the politicians leaving the meeting in Brussels yesterday, they were sort of very downbeat, really, on getting to an agreement. And I think this whole issue of adhering to EU rules and regulations on the environment, on employee rights, etc., is really going to hold up an agreement. And so we don't know. I mean, we really don't know. And that's an awful, awful position for business to be in. Are we going to suddenly get a rush of guidance from the UK government to UK companies, or companies operating in the UK, as to what they need to do as we move into January, February and March next year? I think the uncertainty really is such a burden at the moment. and people are really just sort of sitting on their hands and waiting to see what happens. But, you know, we know there are going to be logistics problems. We know that they're going to be, you know, potentially really damaging issues with tariffs going one way or the other. If you're buying a raw material in to make something and then processing it into something else, which a lot of chemical companies do. And then, of course, you've got the whole regulatory issue as well around REACH, etc. So I'm not optimistic at all.
Paul, are you smiling with your Brexit hat on as the final few weeks of the transition period grind to a halt?
I'm sorry to disagree with my friend Nigel, but I don't think there's ever been any doubt about where we end up, that this government is careless. We've seen this with the COVID pandemic and its incompetence there. It's careless of the detail. Johnson signed the withdrawal agreement clearly without reading it. A year ago, couldn't care less either way. And he's careless about the results. He'll say something, but it doesn't mean anything. He promised the people of Northern Ireland that there would be no paperwork. Well, there's going to be massive paperwork if he doesn't care. As long as he stays in power, that's all that's interesting. And he's got a set of toadies around him who were chosen not because of their ability, but because they are prepared to agree with Brexit. And, you know, so there are very few arguments in favour of Brexit if you're in the chemical industry. But the issue, I think, is simply that people want to believe that a government, particularly a G7 government like the UK's, is actually going to be responsible. To which my answer is, if they were going to be responsible, they would never in a million years have dreamed of doing Brexit in the middle of a pandemic. They would have extended the transition period in the summer when they had the chance, when Europe asked them to do it. The other problem is that these guys are completely and utterly incompetent. They really do believe that the way to negotiate is to say to somebody, this is what we have, this is what we want, and then you sit there and then they will come back to you. And they all believe that at 1 minute to midnight on the 31st of December, there will be a call from Brussels who say, oh, yes, have anything you want. And they don't realise the train has moved on. But Brussels has agreed, you know, accepted. OK, you wanted to leave. This is really bad news for the UK economy. It's really bad. But if you look at what's already happened, 80% of the UK economy is services, and the government has done nothing about services. That's all moved now. All we're doing is we're talking about the other 20%, which is the bit that happens to concern us in the chemicals industry, but that will all move too. It has to. And that's why, of course, my argument earlier about local for local, you can't afford to be importing into the UK through duty barriers and exporting and so on. You've got to restructure the system. And that won't be a bad thing overall. I mean, it's terribly disappointing, but I mean, ever since the lies and so on of the Brexit Leave campaign were allowed to be put forward in 2016 onwards, I think the die has been cast. I mean, you could say, well, I've been, you know, lucky with the forecast that it's like this. I don't feel myself very lucky about it at all. I think it's terrible. But, you know, we are where we are. And people don't understand, I think, that economics does not drive decisions. Economics is, you know, some of us are driven by economic decisions. Most people are driven by politics and social decisions. And, you know, the people who talked about economics just never heard.
And just finally, we'd like to give a few words of sort of practical advice on what the chemical players in the UK should be doing now within these final few weeks.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what is really critical is to assume that there will be no deal and to get on with planning, because it's going to be enormously complicated. I mean, as you know, Will, with some colleagues from the chemical industry, we set up Ready for Brexit, specifically aimed, obviously, at chemical companies. And we've put out planning tools and so on there. And you go into the the level of detail that you have, you know, it's not just a question of tariffs and things like that. It's all about rules of origin. And can you show that you got that raw material in the UK? Or did somebody in making that product, did they buy something from the States or whatever? You know, you've got all these things that you've never thought about in 25 years since we had the single market and customs union. You've now got to recover it. So there's a very precious 3 weeks here. And, you know, and I hope people are going to sign up and really get to grips with what they, you know, the key, this is triage on the battlefield. You know, we've worked with companies who've been planning for this for 2 or 3 years. And you can say, oh, what a waste of time and so on. Well, it isn't a waste of time. The range of things that you have to look at. I mean, working, if you want to take samples to a trade conference from January, do you know what the rules are going to be? Because they've changed. You can't just do it anymore. You know, all of these little things come through. But the big questions are around, do you have money in the bank? Because there's going to be massive delays at the ports. The ports can't cope. That we haven't got the 50,000 customs people that we needed and so on. But there are ways through. If you think about it, and if you plan, there are things you can do. But if you sit back and wait for this government to tell you something, well, you'll be waiting a very long time because they don't know. I mean, they got rid of the Brexit department. There were 3,000 civil servants who'd been working on Brexit for 3 years. They did actually know something about it. All that went. So they don't know what they don't know. And actually, they don't care because they're kept in power by people who believe that Brexit may be painful, but that doesn't matter.
Thanks very much, Paul and Nigel. And if you'd like to learn more about the products and services we have on offer, visit ICIS.com.